Chapter 9, The Self-Destruction of Patriarchy and the Reemergence of Female Power. As I abruptly arrived back at my desk in archetypal dead time, everything was in its usual order. My cup of coffee had gone cold, and my glass of water had become lukewarm, and the papers and books were in disarray as always. It seemed as if I had just been out briefly on an errand. I joked to my feline familiar, Cotty, as I was beginning to feel that I was beginning to feel like an errand messenger from the realm of lost and found. She yawned. I was in a state of shock, naturally, knowing that I really had been way out, participating in a mode of being that is peculiar to those who have discovered lost and found continent. I can look forward to further trips, of course, but there is such a feeling of having gone plop into this dreary world whenever I return. Ah, but here's the magical, wondrous thing. My life in AD changes incrementally with the accumulation of these far-out experiences. I am immeasurably enriched by them, by my memories of them. Having entered an other morphic field, I carry it back with me to this dreary dimension, which never was entirely dreary, because there always were foreglimpses. But these memories of these adventures are not merely some passive baggage that I carry with me. They have lives of their own. They interact with each other, weaving a kind of glistening web of energy. They shine on and transform everything, so that even common things display their participation in this dancing web. Many women have experiences of being in this dimension of energy, which they experience as different from ordinary life. Often the experiences seem like memories of an other world in which colors are different, smells are different, sounds, tastes, textures are different. The memories often are dim in the sense of seeming far away. They are difficult to name. If we employ a name to describe them, we know that is not quite adequate. We may name something on this level, but we are overstretching its power when we apply it to that dimension. One could use the word blue, for example, to name a color, but the word fails, or almost fails. It may work for the speaker who has had this other experience to trigger a memory of that richer, subtler reality, but it cannot really convey the meaning she intends. Perhaps she can speak of the problem of naming it, however, and thereby trigger indirectly some comparable memory in the person to whom she is speaking. It is fruitful to see this range of meaning in connection with the scholastic philosopher's explanation of the analogy of being, which I interpret to mean analogy of being. In the scholastic tradition, in this analogy, the analogates are said to be simply different and somewhat the same. This means that the difference is greater than the sameness. Thus, the rock is being, being. The tree is being, being. The human is being, being. Ultimate reality is being, being. However, the difference in the meaning of being / being is greater than the sameness among these realities. My experience with naming the color range with the same word, example green, is comparable. It is noteworthy that this experience occurred long before I studied scholastic philosophy, which tells me that the insight is intuitive, not contrived. It is, in fact, shockingly real knowledge, like the intuition of being. For this reason, it is difficult to communicate and refrain in a foregrounded world. The strange and almost elusive problem of a kind of amnesia arises. When one has such an otherworld experience, she senses this danger of amnesia in herself. She sometimes fears a loss of a particular memory and prays that the universe will help her remember, or she asks the memory itself to stay with her. She expresses a hope that she will not forget. Sometimes she does forget, perhaps for years. The overcoming of such amnesia is what Lost and Found Continent is all about. Shortly after I wrote the preceding paragraphs, I heard from my friend Anne Marie Palmisiano, who told me that a strange word had popped into her mind very recently while she was doing her laundry. The word was cosmochromatic. To my knowledge, this word does not exist in any dictionary. It does exist on this page, however. Before that, it existed when Anne-Marie first heard it, and then again when we spoke about it. We were both startled by the synchronicities involved in this revelatory event. Cosmochromatic is stunningly apt for naming the cosmic, multidimensional range of reality that can be significant by the name of a specific color. In conversations with Anne-Marie, she has told me about a wonderful dictionary she inherited from her father. This dictionary is called Webster's Complete Reference Dictionary and Encyclopedia. In that work, she encountered the word chromatopsia, therein defined as a morbid state of vision in which objects appear in abnormal colors. In the course of our conversation, we concluded that chromatopsia would certainly characterize the quality of vision in the foregrounded slash unreal state. Of course, we are trained not to notice the degradation of sense perception, as well as the depravity of intellect, emotions, behaviors, social interactions, and values in this state. All of these manifestations of degradation and depravity are interconnected. The abnormally glaring lights and colors of a TV set or shopping mall beckon us into the fake world they so aptly represent. They set us up for myriad encounters with pseudo-reality on the screen and in the mall. By lying to our senses, they lie to our minds, seducing us to mistake the unreal for the real. The feelings slash emotions of those so deceived become twisted. They learn to favor the phony. Bored with nature, they prefer to be surrounded by fake everything. They themselves begin to fake everything. They fake happiness. Fearing the knowledge of unhappiness, they practice the habit of forgetting happiness. Having lost it, they choose not to find it. The victims of TV land and shopping mall hell, as well as meaningless education and jobs, are prime candidates for imprisonment in totalitarian society. This was manifested in early 21st century America by the plutocracy slash oligarchy slash oligarchy, which I shall simply name Bushdom. Bushdoms, Bushdom, began decades, perhaps millennia, before the reign of G.W. Bush, whose absence of presence and breathtaking inanity suggest that he was not only unoriginal, but unquestionably slash unquestioningly a copy. The real question is, copy of what? A procession of nothings, perhaps? The inanity slash banality brings to mind yet again Hannah Arendt's often quoted expression, the banality of evil. Despite the spread of the vacuous non-presence which I name Bushdom, breakthroughs began to occur. The resistance to the U.S. government's warmongering against Iraq, as well as to nuclear threats around the globe, which had been building in the late 1990s and in the first years of the 21st century, was manifested in large peace demonstrations, especially throughout Europe, the Middle East, Australia, and the U.S. A shift in public consciousness was becoming visible, tangible. There were signs that the critical mass required for effective resistance was becoming attainable. I suggest that the primary obstacle to the attainment of critical mass is deadly distraction. Before proceeding further, it is important to reflect further on Bushdom, which was characterized by distraction. J.W. is a major distraction. He is essentially a distraction. G.W. does not matter. He deflects attention from the problem. He is a decoy. This is precisely why Bush and Bushdom are important. They are expansions of the banality of evil. They give new shades to the meaning of the term phony. Here is the reason why so many people insist that they cannot bear the sight of W on television and feel compelled to turn off their sets whenever they hear that voice. If good is that which attracts, evil is that which disgusts and distracts. Hitler and Mussolini failed to achieve the degree of horrifying absence which is projected by the selected president of the world's only remaining superpower, the non-elected resident of the White House. It is not simply a case of unpleasant personal appearance. TV screens and newspapers are full of ugly men's faces and bodies. Nor is it merely a grinding, irritating voice, think Kissinger. The GW phenomenon is that which radically repels by flagrantly flaunting absence of being. As I continued to dwell upon this thought, I recalled newspaper photos of the Bush gang in Washington, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Powell, and, oh, Condoleezza Rice, the ultimate double token slash double cross. I thought of the 2003 editorial in the New York Times on Bush's war against women. I thought of the millions of actual and potential victims of weapons of mass destruction, not just members of the human species, but all species of living beings on Earth. I heard in my mind a line in Adrian Rich's poem, Hunger, quantify suffering, you could rule the world. That's what it's all about, I thought for the 100th time. They intend to finish the job for Hitler 1,000 times more efficiently and powerful than Adolf could have managed to do. They intend to rule and ruin the world. I shouted this at Cottie, who was dozing sweetly on her green armchair. She woke up, giving me an annoyed glance. Alarmed at the slowness of my thought process, she rolled over. I slumped over my desk, dropping my head on my arms. I then raised my head and howled. Suddenly, the door of my study swung open. In strode Kate, yelling, "Please stop that noise. We heard you on Lost and Found Continent. You woke us all up." I turned around and stared. Then I jumped up and hugged Kate. "You came all this way. Thank you," I exclaimed. "It's not so far. You know very well," she said, "just a holler away." "It's good to be reminded of that," I said. "We're all so drained back here. Bushed, that is, to borrow the term from Emily Culpepper." "Remember your own words about hopping hope," said Kate. "You can hop out of this dreary dimension if you really want to. You don't have to let yourself be bushed around by arrogant snools." At the sound of Kate's voice, Cottie suddenly hopped up from her cozy green chair and landed on my desk, where she sat up sturdily, confirming Kate's words with her determined stare. "You see, Cottie gets it," exclaimed Kate, taking the cat's place on the green chair. "She's saying, come back here to your computer, Mary, and write. It's by your writing that you keep your hope hopping. It hops from one woman to another, from one animal to another, from one dimension to another. This hope is contagious, and your hopping slash writing is extremely important to Cottie and to us, Mary." "Oh, I do know that is true, Kate," I said. "That cat is constantly urging me on. She waits for hours on my desk chair while I'm getting my act together before sitting down to work. And while I'm writing, she often goes into what seems to be a kind of doze or trance, lying on her front paws outstretched, deeply in harmony with the vibrations that surround the process of writing. When she senses that I'm pushing too late to the night, trying to finish a section and becoming unproductive because of fatigue, she comes over and rubs against my legs, hinting that it's time to quit, have a snack, and go to bed. Back in 2003, when I was distracted from my own work by horrifying news about the war against terrorism, that cat actually went on hunger strikes for days. I think she was trying to shock me into getting my priorities straight." "Clearly, she is a very special companion animal," said Kate. "She is an incredibly inspiring and encouraging partner in the creation of this book, Kate. I'd like to tell you about something astonishing that she did just a few years ago." I said this hesitantly, hoping I was not sounding like an excessively proud parent. "I'm all ears," responded my guest with a partially suppressed smile. "Well, she'd been sitting there, where you are, on the green chair. You can see that chair is very close to the bookcase on your left." Kate turned to examine the overfilled bookshelves. "I can see that the shelves are jam-packed with a wide variety of books. At first glance, the volumes don't seem to be arranged in very strict categories," she commented. Right, I said, and part of Coddy's genius is the ability to unscramble them. This talent has manifested just the other day, when suddenly this inquisitive cat hopped up to the left arm of that chair, which brought her about even with the middle shelf. She began searching among the books there, and paused when her nose was directly pointed at the spine of a nondescript paperback, which I didn't immediately recognize. When I pulled it out, I was amazed to see it was 1984 by George Orwell, a book that has been in my mind for years, but which apparently had been lost before she found it. Lost and found, Kate exclaimed. Probably you should read it right away. I agreed. I did open it immediately and read some lines about Oceania's war with East Asia and or Eurasia. These struck a familiar note, not only because I had read them before, but also because they were aptly descriptive of what human society is rapidly becoming in the early years of the 21st century. Orwell's book presents a horrifying picture of a world in which doublethink prevails, memory is destroyed, and capacity to reason is broken, and all genuine love, self-respect, loyalty, and hope for a real future are gone. Kate's eyes flashed. It certainly is a pretentious book, but it would seem unlikely that such a dystopian novel would engender hopping hope. Come to think of it, though, I remember reading it back there/then, and subsequently feeling impelled to leap toward an other kind of future. It helped drive me to reach out towards the archaic future and search for lost and found continent. That was the great biophilic response to a necrophilic book, Kate, I said. As you recall, the year 2048 BE was the year I first visited Lost and Found Continent. I remember that we were all acutely aware that 48 reverses 84. It was then that your audacious daughter Annie and I celebrated together the final defeat of Big Brother. It was Annie who proclaimed he finally shriveled up and died ignominiously of his own inherent rottenness. We congratulated ourselves and our four sisters on this victory. Kay laughed. It was a great coincidence that 48 reverses 84, and what a cosmic synchronicity it was that we managed to bring out the 2048 edition of Quintessence on Lost and Found Continent just in time for the publication of the book in Boston by Beacon Press. That made it possible for Beacon to include the cosmic comments and conversations with the author that were written by Annie, whose pen name is, of course, Anonyma. Eager to push ahead with my discussion of Coddy's findings, I said, almost immediately after she pointed to 1984, Coddy selected a second book for me from that shelf. This time she did not simply point with her nose. She actually picked the book with her paw, partially dislodging it from its place. When I pulled it out, I saw that this slender volume is entitled Panhandling Papers, and it is by Katie, and that the beautiful drawing of Katie on the cover was done by Paula Gottlieb in 1981. The book, which was published in 1989, is beautifully made. It consists of 217 pages. The paper, the binding, and the print are of excellent quality. The back cover sports an excellent cover of Katie crouching with a cat, and the photo is copyright in 1983. Panhandling Papers was officially self-published in 1989 by Kay Vanderis, i.e. Katie. In sum, Katie's book was a labor of wild honesty, courage, and love. Coddy exhibited true canineness in her selection of those two books, said Kate. Yes, I replied. Comparing them is a remarkable experience. For example, I've been thinking about Winston's secret projects in 1984 of writing a book against Big Brother. He had to write this book in secrecy, in a state of perpetual fear of being found out. This situation was plausible to the reader because of the context, which was 1984. But then, I continued, as I read the words of Katie, I remembered vividly the fact that in the foreground, every year is 1984 for women. The first essay in Panhandling Papers, which was written in 1979, contains the following lines. A journal is a notebook in which I write to myself in secret. The only time most women can speak honestly is in a secret notebook. Katie continues that essay with the following paragraph. When we write in our journals, we are speaking silently and nobody hears. But now we begin to dare to read our journals aloud. We begin to find our voices. We begin to see, hear, say, I'm talking about 5,000 years of slavery, my slavery, my mother's, her mother's, all the women in the world, for generations and generations. Nobody knows what to do, and yet we are doing it. Millions of obscure women begin to dare to speak. Our pens are dangerous weapons. We pool our wisdom. I pondered briefly in foolish amazement the fact that this essay was written only 26 years ago, but then I re-remembered that the difference between women's condition in 1979 and in the early 21st century is not really so great. It might seem so, especially to privileged academics, but the reality is that, despite foreground changes, Big Brother still looms everywhere and things are getting worse. The date is perpetually 1984 for women. An astonishing synchronicity began to reveal itself to me when I flipped back to the epigraph in the very beginning of Katie's book. For those who follow their enthusiasms into deep and treacherous waters, where they must struggle to keep from drowning, before going down for the last time, your life flashed before you as a panorama. Clutch your pen and write. Go on and write, fool, before your heart breaks. Written by my grandmother Kate a long time ago. So Katie's grandmother's name was Kate, I continued, and Kate encouraged Katie, and by implication all women, to write. When I read this, I thought of my own grandmother, whose name was also Kate. The plot thickens. Browsing through the book, I learn that Katie identifies herself as follows. My name is Katie, daughter of Anne, daughter of Kate, daughter of Anna, daughter of Anna. My mind raced back and ahead at the same time. I first thought of the fact that my own mother's name was, / is, Anna, and that she was often called Anne for short. In that same instant, I recalled the fact that my mother's mother's name was, / is, Kate, and that my grandmother's, Kate's mother's name was, / is, Joanna. I then re-remembered that my mother's baptismal name was Joanna, after her grandmother, but, as she explained, she did not care much for that name, and so she was called Anna, sometimes Anne. In order to tease her, my father occasionally called her Josie. My, how it all came together. In that moment of discovery of the odd synchronicity between Katie's genealogy and my own, my mind was brought to focus on the genesis of the Anonima Network, a group of far-seeing four sisters who discovered Lost and Found Continent in 2018 BE. The origins of this network are described by Annie in her preface to the 1948 BE edition of Quintessence as follows. As a member of the network, I chose to write under the noble name Anonima, but my friends just call me Annie. My mother, whose name is Kate, was born in 1980. From her earliest years, she imbibed understanding of the women's movement from her mother, Joanna. My grandmother, Joanna, who was born in 1948, participated wholeheartedly in the movement. Turning to my transtemporal visitor, I said, "So you see, Kate, how compounded these odd coincidences are." "And you had not read Katie's book before you wrote Quintessence?" queried Kate. "I mean, perhaps that could have influenced you." "If I did, I have no conscious memory of having read it," I responded. Kate was looking at me intently. "I'm beginning to make some sense of all this," she said. "You told me that your experience with Coddy finding Orwell's and Katie's books occurred in late February or early March of 2003 A.D. That was just a few weeks before that hideous war initiated by the Bush administration against Iraq actually happened, isn't that right?" "Yes," I replied, trying to get the date straight in my mind. "You know, I have been horribly distracted from my writing by the grotesque media coverage of the war. It has had kind of a hypnotic effect, and it is addictive. So you came just in time, Kate. You are jolting me out of my state of distraction." "That's good," said Kate. "As you have repeatedly pointed out in your books, philocracies, wars, and media do have just that effect, cutting off women from our own selves, our own work, and creativity. So now I think it's time for us to pull some threads together. It seems to me that when you brought up the subject of coincidental naming of Katie's genealogy in your own, and then linked all this with the name of your friends on Lost and Found Continent, you were describing an amazingly intense sense of temporal convergence. You were expressing the intertwining of past, present, and future. and your keen awareness of such convergence seems to be connected with the Butch's gang's cruel and unjust war. Our awareness of our own positive convergence can be triggered by this manifestation of evil, I said. The criminally insane obsession with manufacturing and seeking out weapons of mass destruction creates a scenario from hell, brought into our living room in living color and sound. Mass murder, torture, and dismemberment of living creatures and of the elements is daily entertainment. The theme behind this made-for-TV war was apocalypse soon. Yes, and the invasion of Iraq was only one stage in Bush's attempt to manufacture a new world order. It fits together nicely with Homeland Security. W's brazen use of Nazi-sounded jargon gives the show away. It gives me chills, said Kate with a shudder. It feels to me as if the drum beats on the madmen's march towards Armageddon are sounding louder, I said. Many women tell me that they are haunted by a sense of horror. And that is precisely why we invited you to visit us on Lost and Found Continent, and why I'm here with you now, Kate reminded me patiently. It's time for us to realize our temporal convergence. We have gone before you, and we continue to go before you with your help. You are helping us realize the archaic future just as we are supporting you. I gulped in astonishment at my own obtuseness. How could I have these lapses into amnesia? I muttered to no one in particular. Then, clearing my throat, I addressed my guest. Thank you once again, Kate, for nudging me into remembering our empowering convergence, I said. Don't mention it, she responded. Let's just contemplate the spectacle of the self-annihilation of patriarchy, which, of course, we happily promote at every opportunity, and celebrate the re-emergence of bibliophilia. Sounds great to me, I exclaimed. Now, Kate, how about an invigorating lunch break before we take our next great leap? Kate expressed her enthusiastic consent as we both stood up and headed for the kitchen, where we searched in my well-stocked refrigerator for some refreshing snacks.